Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm your host, Maria Armudian. In this hour, we continue to examine the real changes brought in the Obama administration and why the media missed it. Then, voter suppression tactics are on the rise and have become more sophisticated, according to election watchdogs. How much has changed over time and how might it affect the upcoming election? Last week, we began our conversation with award-winning journalist and author Michael Grunwald. He described the process of passing the president's signature policies. We continue now with part two of what he calls President Obama's New Deal, beginning with how mischaracterized President Obama's stimulus was.
The stimulus could not have been less popular. A year after it passed, the percentage of Americans who believed it had created jobs was lower than the percentage of Americans who believed Elvis was alive. Then he does this auto bailout everybody hates, Obamacare, which is like this epithet, which, there's going to be a revolution. Cap and trade is even worse. And then got 4 years of high unemployment. You'd think this guy would be at 20% in the polls, right? But no, he actually might get reelected. And so here all the time, like, oh, why did he do health care? It did provide health insurance for 40 million people, and it was unpopular, but it's a divided country, and half the country doesn't like him, and half the country seems to be okay with him. That probably would have been true whether or not he did health care, and it certainly would have been true whether or not he did the stimulus. It's probably a good idea to prevent a depression and keep his campaign promises on energy, education, health care, and tax cuts while he was at it.
In your book, you said that they actually took strategy from the Taliban.
Yeah. They said that they wanted to be insurgents, and they said they had something they could learn from the Taliban. They did. They had a PowerPoint that said, if the purpose of the majority is to govern, what is the purpose of the minority? And the next slide said, the purpose of the minority is to get the majority. It's cynical. It's political. It's, I guess, not putting country first, as they had been the big Republican line in 2008. But it was pretty shrewd. And it's a sort of problem in our system, in that as the country has gotten more and more polarized and politics has become more and more of a zero-sum game, what they did was very rational. There's this cult of the presidency where he's held responsible for everything that's happening in the world. And so it's not really in the interest of the minority to help things get better. Because the president's, as they saw, the president would just get credit for it. So you see this situation where they're trying to block unemployment benefits being extended and even small business tax cuts that were the heart of the Republican message for God knows how long, and middle class tax cuts and highways and even green energy, which the loan program that produced Solyndra had been a bipartisan program that President Bush signed into law. But all of this stuff, once it became Obama's stuff, it suddenly became Sharia socialism and all the rest, where in the same way that the individual mandate for healthcare, which was pioneered by Mitt Romney, that's now, unconstitutional and insanity. And cap and trade, which McCain and Palin had supported in 2008, that's cap and tax and destroying the economy. The good news, I guess, is that if they take power, presumably these are not deeply held beliefs.
Since you prompted it, say Obama loses the next election and Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan do end up in the White House, do you see a turning back of what you call the New Deal, of all of these kind of stimulus programs that are designed to help things like healthcare and the environment?
Well, it's hard to know, right? Because in 2010, when Republicans had their pledge to America, one of their number one promises was that we're going to rescind all the unspent stimulus money. And at the time, there was a couple hundred billion dollars. And then they took back the House, and of the couple hundred billion dollars, they only rescinded zero. Because people don't like having their money rescinded. And even not so recent history of the Republican Party is that they talk a very good game on tax cuts, and then they keep their word. And they talk a really good game on spending cuts, and then they don't keep their word. Because they're also talking a big game on deficits, where they don't keep their word. So I think it's kind of unlikely that they would actually roll back stuff that's actually been done.
And popular, especially
right.
If it's popular.
But that said, and things like high-speed rail, which obviously in California, you're going to need a lot more money if you really want to finish this thing. I think high-speed rail is going to have a lot of trouble under a Republican administration. Things like like the smart grid, though, or health IT, where we put in $27 billion, and that had always been bipartisan, but George Voinovich said in the book, Obama was for it, we had to be against it. Republicans voted against it in lockstep, but look, we've got online dating, we've got online banking. Like, it's crazy that when you go to the doctor, you have to fill out the same 30 forms every time, and that he might kill you with his chicken scratch handwriting. It's just not tenable. And this really was the jump start that really is going to drag us into the digital age. And it's very hard for me to imagine Mitt Romney trying to turn that back.
Let me just remind listeners that we're speaking with Michael Gronwald, and we're talking about his new book called The New New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. I want to talk about the procedural aspect and what actually is going on in the lawmaking process.
I'm not just being glib when I say that change that doesn't have 60 votes in the Senate doesn't make change. That was a real obstacle, and the filibuster loomed over everything. I mean, they had to get 60 votes if they wanted things to pass, and that changes the dynamics. For instance, you hear all the time from the left, like, oh, why wasn't the stimulus bigger? Well, it wasn't bigger because there were 58 Democrats and you had three Republicans who were saying absolutely no more than $800 billion. You also had at least half a dozen Democrats who were saying the same thing. I would guess it would have been more if it ever really came to it. They didn't need more, because once you had 10 people saying no more than $800 billion, it was like, all right, well, now we know how big it's going to be. And that's, first of all, been disappointing for some people, who it's true that more stimulus would have saved more jobs, more aid to states would have save more teachers and firefighters. People remember the stuff about, you know, that made it sound like he was going to wave a magic wand and the oceans were going to stop rising and the lions were going to lie down with the lambs and all that. Because essentially, it's a belief that change can happen. In Washington, that's a kind of audacious belief. Then he went ahead and did it. And it wasn't exactly what he said he was going to do. He had said he wouldn't do an individual mandate for healthcare because he didn't think it was necessary. But Max Baucus thought it was necessary. So, okay, we're going to do an individual mandate for healthcare. This is a book about the process of making change. But what I always try to emphasize is that this was a lot of change.
In one bill.
Exactly.
And this is one of the, I think, important points of your book, because you do compare it to the New Deal and you do compare him to FDR.
That's right. I mean, and this was in his first month before most of his aides knew where the bathrooms were in the West Wing, right? It's really kind of astonishing. And he didn't create these alphabet agencies with vast armies of government workers.
Which wouldn't have gone over anyway.
Right. There was no political support, and it would have taken too long in our modern bureaucracy. And he didn't create new entitlements like Social Security or deposit insurance. I mean, he didn't really create big government, because FDR already did that. And he's not a classic New Deal liberal. But that said, what they really have in common is, first of all, they were both responses to economic emergencies. As Larry Summers said in December 2008, FDR was lucky. He had 3 years of the Depression before he took over. Everybody knew it was Hoover's Depression, while Obama took over when the unemployment rate was still pretty low, but rising really fast. No matter what he had done, the unemployment rate was going to keep rising, and that created a real problem. But again, this was a real vast economic response to an economic emergency. But really what they have in common is that their legacy will be change. And it's different kinds of change. Instead of like the Grand Coulee Dam, you have America's largest dam removal project to restore salmon flows on the Elwha River. Instead of the Triborough Bridge, you have the world's largest wind farm and a half dozen of the world's largest solar arrays. It's a different kind of change, but it is exactly the change that he laid out during his campaign, that policy agenda that nobody was paying attention to because they were excited about his fancy speeches and his race and his crazy pastor and the ads comparing him to Paris Hilton. But he had a very specific policy agenda, and the four pillars were energy, education, healthcare, and really the kind of structure of the economy. He made a whole bunch of promises of what he was going to do in his inaugural address, and he went ahead and did it.
We talked about how much of this was missed by the traditional media. Now, these are your colleagues.
Yeah. I do feel that by not being in Washington, I'm sort of freed me to write this book, because in Washington, the notion that, like, taking the stimulus seriously, just it was like admitting that you weren't in on the joke. The herd mentality was just so strong. And I really feel that if I was still in D.C., if I was still inside the Beltway, I'm a pretty contrarian guy, but I don't think I could have written this book. What I've written about the stimulus, if I tried doing that while I was in Washington, it would have been like writing that the BP spill didn't happen.
So is it because you couldn't have seen the forest from the trees, so to speak, would have been caught up in the groupthink, or would it have been that you would have lost your sources and been outcast?
No, but I would say the basic conclusion of the book were hidden in plain sight. Anybody could have done it. And it's kind of shocking to me that they didn't. I always say that really the media blew this story as badly as it blew the run-up to the war in Iraq. And I think I can explain how it happened. I think you had the Republicans who were really relentless in portraying this as a mess. You had the Democrats who were essentially also portraying it as a mess for different reasons. You have a national media that's not very interested in public policy, that is lazy, that likes to do he said, she said stories. And there you have sort of he said it's a mess and she said it's a mess. Add to that, you have this kind of overlay of the cult of the presidency that I talked about, particularly in Washington, where when the president is up, everything he does is when he lands on the Air Force carrier and says mission accomplished, he's the greatest thing since sliced bread. But when the president is down and he's flying over Hurricane Katrina looking pensive out the window, then he's an idiot and there's nothing he can do about it. And I think there was a sense of that this was a jobs bill that passed at a time when jobs were hemorrhaging. And it was a Keynesian stimulus, which was blowing $800 billion of borrowed money into the economy at a time when we're saying that, hey, you know, this whole mess was caused by banks playing with money they didn't have and homeowners taking out loans they didn't afford. And so now when everybody's tightening their belt and families and businesses are hurting, Barack Obama's going to come in and spend $800 billion. It wasn't intuitive and it was instantly unpopular, especially since we had just thrown $700 billion at Wall Street. So I think the narrative got set early, and I can almost understand how the narrative got set because there was a perfect storm. But it is sort of shocking how unwilling people are in Washington to challenge the narrative. I would point out that there were local reporters who did a really good job of reporting on local stimulus projects. And there were education reporters did a fine job of covering Race to the Top. And I don't mean that they were soft on it. I mean that they covered it. They were tough but fair. But it was rarely in the context of the stimulus. Even business reporters would write about, hey, the market went up today and it's probably because there's talk of more stimulus. There wasn't this kind of reinventing Keynesian economics, which was really completely uncontroversial in the profession before it became Obama's Keynesian economics. It was only the sort of national reporters, the political reporters, and the investigative reporters who really became kind of runaway prosecutors and could do no right. Some poor guy at the USA Today who I singled out because I kept a gotcha file and I realized like he was the star of my gotcha file. But one week he would write that the stimulus was spending disproportionate amounts of money in rural areas. And then the next week it was spending disproportionate amounts of money in urban areas. Then one week it was not getting the money out the door fast enough. And the next week the headline would be traffic set to slow as stimulus gears up, which is like my favorite headline. It's like the ultimate finding the cloud and every silver lining. But there really was the sense that as long as it was a mess, like you don't get a Pulitzer Prize for doing an investigation that doesn't find wrongdoing. And everybody had said that 5 to 7% of this thing was going to be lost to fraud. As it's turned out, it's been 0.01%, but everybody wanted to go find their boondoggle.
It's fascinating to me as a student of political science in mass media and that intersection. The segment I taped right before you dealt with political scandal. And the nexus between what you've done and what they were talking about is the strategic rhetoric of the Republican Party to turn it into a scandal, then it creates this kind of cultural bubble or groupthink, as you call it.
Right. Well, they were smart about repeating their themes. But there is this kind of zero defect mentality in government. People say like, oh, you know, we want government to run more like a business. But I think usually when they say that, they mean they're actually thinking of the opposite. In business, venture funds and other and project finance and banks, they lend money all the time. They have Solyndras all the time. Some loans go bad. That's just the way it is. Solyndra raised $1 billion from private investors. It was the toast of Silicon Valley. It just happened out that its business model wasn't suited for a time when solar was getting cheap, and it failed. But that's not a scandal. But I remember talking to Steve Chu and Arun Majumdar, who was the head of ARPA-E, and other guys in the Department of Energy, as they were talking about this exciting new, because one of the sort of aspects of change in this book is that it really did sort of change the way government does business. The classic way that government hands out money is it's sort of the entitlement mentality, where if you want to do a road project, you do your traffic study, you do your small business hiring report, your minority hiring report, you check all your compliance boxes, and then the government sends you money. Nobody ever asks you, does your project make any sense? And the stimulus really tried to do much more through competition, where you had to prove that you had economic and environmental benefits. And on this energy stuff, really that you're, you know, that you had a business model, that your company was really helping us get off fossil fuels, that it was something new. And there were some really tough choices. But what they kept saying was, you know, we're pioneers, and pioneers can't be afraid to fail. And what I would always ask them is, yeah, but then what happens when something fails? And they would say, oh, we're prepared for that. And of course, they were not prepared for that. I tell stories about how Vice President Biden really went to unbelievable lengths to make sure that there were no scandals in this thing, that his people were poring over every dollar. They killed 260 projects just because they didn't like the smell of them. And he used to always say, if somebody finds out that we wasted $1 billion, this thing is done, and government's going to get a bad name, and all the people who think the government can't run a one-car funeral are going to say, aha, I told you so. And, you know, Solyndra really was, it could have happened to anybody. It did. You know, the Bush administration pushed it too. This is what happened. You have the world's largest project finance team. Some of your finance is gonna go south. And John McCain's finance chairman oversaw a review of that loan program and has found that it's doing fine. And it's financing all kinds of really exciting projects. But all people hear about is Solyndra, Solyndra, Solyndra.
Well, let's contrast that then with all of the positive change that you talked about in the New New Deal. I think there were three areas: the environment, education, and healthcare. The area that you're most versed in is the environment. So let's talk about what some of those are.
Sure. With energy, I mean, you know, when Obama took office, the wind industry was essentially dead. And partly because it's financed by these tax credits that now Mitt Romney wants to kill. And at the time in 2008, nobody had any tax appetite. So really, there were literally wind turbines rusting in the field. At the time, we had 25 gigawatts of wind in the United States, and the official federal forecast said that we would have 40 gigawatts by 2030. Well, they passed the stimulus. The next day, the head of Iberdrola, which is a Spanish company, announced that he was investing $6 billion in U.S. wind farms. Today, we already have 50 gigawatts of wind. We've doubled it. Solar has increased more than 600%. We've jump-started a smart grid where you have more than 10 million smart meters, which I know are somewhat...
Explain that for our listeners who
sure.
don't know.
Sure. The smart grid is essentially... The quick explanation is it's like... It's a merger between our old electrical grid that was, you know, essentially hasn't changed since the 19th century. It's sort of merging it with the internet. So you're distributing information as well as electrons. And the idea is to get to this brave new world where it's partly, the main thing is that, you know, a tree branch won't fall in Cleveland and black out eight states like happened a few years ago. The system will be much more reliable. It will allow much more renewables that, you know, so that the system won't freak out when the wind stops blowing or the sun stops shining. I mean, you won't have to turn on a really expensive, they call them peaking plants. But really, it's also about giving people more control of their energy so that you'll be able to set your air conditioner from your iPhone, and your dishwasher will talk to your utility to run when power is cheapest, and your electric vehicle will be able to store power for the grid and then sell power back to the grid when the grid needs it and take it when you need it. And then, of course, there'll be you know, just like we didn't know with the internet what's going to be the Wikipedia or the eBay of the grid, there's going to be exciting things that are going to happen. And people have been talking about this for decades. And the long story short is that the stimulus poured in $11 billion and has jump-started it. And it'll depend on, you know, the pace, who knows. It'll go fast, it'll go slow, depending on public policy and the economy and who's running the utilities. But again, it's not going to turn back. So that's another example of change. Electric vehicles are, again, you know, we had the capacity to produce 1% of the world's batteries before the stimulus. By 2015, we'll have the capacity to do 500,000 cars, which should be about 40%. So it's really, these are just complete game-changing investments in, you know, clean coal, the first commercial plants. We'll see how that works out. Energy efficiency in every imaginable form. We've weatherized 1 million low-income homes, poured $5 billion into federal buildings, which will lower costs for taxpayers as well as reducing carbon emissions. And so, I mean, you know, there ought to be a kind of a national debate about this kind of green industrial policy. But what I've pushed for is to have it be a debate about the actual stimulus.
Like the reality.
And not the imaginary stimulus.
Kind of like that, Joe Biden said, facts matter, facts matter.
Exactly, exactly. And he did point out, you know, that, you know, Paul Ryan pulled out that talking point about how there are 100 energy investigations going on of stimulus funds. And it's true. But so far, those investigations have turned up $2.3 million worth of fraud out of $37 billion that's been spent in this area.
And I think he said no actual criminal wrongdoing or anything like that they had found. Is that
correct?
Yeah,
no. Most of the crime has been, you know, the stimulus did, among other things that people didn't notice. You know, there were $300 billion in tax cuts. And they were also, they sent $250 checks to elderly and disabled veterans. And the usual fraud, you know, people stealing checks, that's been the vast majority of the fraud has been like people stealing other people's tax cuts or, you know, signing up for, you know, a check when they weren't 65 or that, you know, or a disabled veteran. I interviewed the investigator who was in charge of overseeing the stimulus, and he's this tough guy who he exposed the Jack Abramoff scandal. He caught those oil executives sleeping with oil regulators during the Bush administration. And he told me, he's like, I've been flabbergasted by how clean this thing is. It's, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican or a communist. You've got to be excited about how, you know, after all that talk about how 5 to 7% of this would be lost to fraud, it's been 0.001%.
Wow. Education.
Yeah, well, Race to the Top is a really big deal, and there were big fights over how much it would be, and they ended up getting about $5 billion for Race to the Top and a couple of other real big reforms. At the same time, there were also a couple hundred billion dollars in aid to states that got no attention that helped governors and mayors who were about to lay off hundreds of thousands of teachers and firefighters and cops. That was probably the biggest thing it did for education, was prevent all those layoffs. Overall, we've still lost 600,000 government jobs in the supposedly socialistic Obama era. But those would have been just devastating cuts, not only to the system, but to the economy, because they would have been really immediate. And by reducing that, it was probably the best stimulus of all the stimulus.
And healthcare.
Well, there the most exciting thing is health IT, I think. And by 2017, every American should have an electronic medical record. And that just has really exciting possibilities for improving care and reducing costs. Which, remember, what really set Obama apart from other Democrats on healthcare during the 2008 election is that he was obsessed with the cost of healthcare. And it is he talked about it not just as a moral issue, that it's too expensive so people can't afford it, and it's, you know, creating all these personal bankruptcies, but also as an economic issue for the country. Because when you have healthcare benefits, you're basically locked into that job. You're too scared to go out on your own and start a business. Companies like GM, that really they have 7 times the healthcare cost of a Japanese car, and it's really dragged them down. When people talk about the long-term deficit problem that the United States has, or long-term fiscal sustainability problems, it's essentially a healthcare problem. It's because healthcare is too expensive. And health IT is really the foundation for healthcare reform. Because if you've ever gone to the doctor we can't find that file, or we can't find that test you took last Tuesday, so we'll just give it to you again. Once you have an electronic medical record, you don't have to go to two different doctors to show them your file. They can look at it at the same time. Just the visits to specialists, the redundant tests, the medical errors that kill tens of thousands of Americans every year, electronic prescribing so that chicken scratch handwriting doesn't end you up, get you the wrong prescription. And then the possibility of using another stimulus program in comparative effectiveness research, which it sounds crazy, but really in America, we have no idea which are the best treatments. To get a drug approved, you don't have to prove that it's better than any other drug. You just have to prove it's better than a placebo. To get a device approved, you don't have to even prove that it's better than a placebo. You just have to prove that it won't kill you. So now the stimulus poured $1 billion into really kind of getting patients and doctors the kind of information about what works. And you can imagine the synergy when your doctor is treating you with his iPad instead of his clipboard, and he says, oh, we have X, Y, and Z. Well, what are the usual protocols that have the best medical evidence behind you? And his iPad can recommend that. These are all ways of making the system more efficient. And probably 30% of our medical system right now is just waste. Mm. And as with banking, as with dating, the computers can make it a lot more efficient.
Now, with this background and having just had debates, what accounts for Obama not being able to talk about these things in the first debate, which was all about the domestic issues?
I always point out that this black guy whose middle name is Hussein and somehow got himself elected president of the United States, he probably knows something about politics. He probably didn't become a complete idiot on January 20th, 2009. And I also try to point out that, of course, I have a sort of interest in, I wish he'd go out and say, actually, there was a new deal. You should just read this Grunwald book and then you'll understand. There are political considerations where they feel like they don't want to be bragging about the last 4 years at a time when people are hurting. That said, I think there were a lot of people who in 2008 thought they were voting for change. And I do tell this hidden story of change. These people who now feel like kind of disillusioned and whatever happened to all that change the guy said he was going to do, it strikes me that it wouldn't kill him to point out every now and then that, yeah, he actually did it.
You point out the New Deal and the New Deal have legacy value, but are not instantaneous.
Right. And certainly some of the, they didn't have to put up signs by the highway. I think only 22 states put up those signs saying that, these are stimulus projects, and those signs are so silly that who even knows what they're saying. But that said, he does you hear him talk about how he's doubled renewable energy. He talks about how he cut taxes for 95% of the country. He does talk about how we were losing 800,000 jobs and that now gaining 150,000 jobs a month may not feel great, but it's a lot better than where we were. There was this aura inside the administration that kind of if you do the policy right, the politics will kind of take care of itself. And the best example is actually those tax cuts, where I tell the story of how, Bush did a stimulus back when Republicans liked stimulus. And what they did was they sent everybody a check. So you got your check from George W. Bush. But Obama's behavioral economist told them that the studies found that when you just send somebody a check, they're more likely to save it. And that doesn't stimulate the economy. So it's better to just sort of dribble it out a few dollars a week through reduced withholding so that people don't notice it and they're more likely to spend it. But then they don't notice it.
Right.
And so Rahm Emanuel was running around saying hey, we're denying ourselves this Ed McMahon moment, right? That sort of squeal of Publishers Clearinghouse pleasure where you get that check in the mail from Barack. And I think, I did quote somebody in the White House who said, look, we thought that if we just did the policy right, we'd get results and that would be good politics. But in retrospect, it was just stupid. Less than 10% of the country realized that they got these tax cuts.
Well, I think particularly when you have an opposition that's that strong and that's that adamant about winning, and in your colleagues, the traditional journalists who wouldn't go outside of that frame.
Right. Plus Democrats not defending it and Obama sort of being on to the next. Yeah, I think it was sort of a perfect storm in terms of the politics. But again, you do all these incredibly unpopular things, and the election still might come down to some waiter with a camera phone catching the Republican candidate talking about the 47% at some fundraiser. So the lesson is, like, when you have the power, you might as well do stuff. And what I did try to show is that, sort of like it or not, he did stuff.
And the book, again, is called The New New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. Michael Grunwald is with us. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
When we come back, voter suppression tactics, past and present, can they affect the upcoming election? Stay tuned. Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Since January 2011, at least 180 bills were introduced in 41 states in efforts to restrict or suppress voting, according to the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU. But nearly all of the worst new laws were blocked or repealed, largely as a result of actions in the courts. Some measures that still remain could affect up to 5 million citizens in this election. Some election watchdog groups have suggested that suppression efforts are becoming more sophisticated and difficult to control within the current laws. We are joined by three experts. Alexander Kasar is professor of history and social policy at Harvard University. His book, The Right to Vote: The Contested History of Democracy in the United States, was named the best book in U.S. history by both the American Historical Association and the Historical Society, and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Daniel Takagi is professor of law, senior fellow of election law at Ohio State University, co-author of Casebook Election Law, and co-editor of the Election Law Journal. Lorraine Minniti is professor of public policy and administration and director of undergraduate urban studies at Rutgers University. She is author of The Myth of Voter Fraud and co-author of Keeping Down the Black Vote, Race and the Demobilization of American Voters. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to start with a historic context. Professor Kasar, how would you contextualize what we're dealing with today?
I think this is not a new phenomenon in the United States, although I think certainly it's a resurgent one and one becoming newly severe. The classic period when I think there were sort of very significant outbreaks of voter suppression occurred in the late 19th century, and they occurred both in the North and the South. The Southern story is very well known, and it began as an attempt to suppress the votes of African Americans, or the freedmen in the South. In fact, it's in that period that the phrase vote suppression first starts to appear any significant numbers in the American press. And that segues in the South into complete disfranchisement of African Americans. In the North, in the late 19th century and the early 20th century, was a phenomenon that seems to me more like what we're seeing today, which was voter suppression efforts aimed largely at immigrant workers and poor people. And it was done in a context where there was no chance of actually disfranchising people. The political strength of these voters was too strong, and the ideological commitment was rather strong. But this is when you start seeing things like literacy tests in the North, which were very important, were requirements that immigrants had to bring their naturalization papers to the polls, or registration requirements requiring prospective voters to register every year or every time they moved a few blocks. These were efforts to reduce the strength of certain groups of voters. And then those efforts continue on and off. I think they subside to some degree around the middle of the 20th century, and then they've been really resurgent to some extent for the last 20 or 30 years, but most markedly in the last 10.
What would you say have been the key justifications, at least the public justifications, for trying to enact these kinds of policies?
The public justification almost invariably is to prevent fraud. It's very interesting. In the late 19th century, what was said was that it was to prevent the urban political machines, the Irish political machines or the Italian political machines, from stuffing the ballot box. And now exactly why that would require you to take some of the steps that these laws required was unclear in the past as it is today. But the justification is almost always fraud. And the targets are almost always poor and working class people. For one thing, voting fraud does occur, but it is also a rationale put forward for what are laws, in effect, that invariably burden the right to vote of some individuals.
Lorraine Minnity.
While there can be some, I would call them sort of shenanigans or knuckleheads every now and then doing something stupid, more likely what you see with respect to irregularities, you know, numbers don't match up and so forth, there's a better explanation for that, I think, which is simply problems with election administration and the fact that we have human error in the system, we have systems that don't work as well as they should. That is a much more likely explanation for those sorts of irregularities that are seized upon by people who want to make a case that we have all this election fraud and therefore we need these new kinds of integrity, they're called measures, to protect the vote. I think that's been another lesson over the last 10 years. And it's good, too, that political scientists really didn't pay much attention to election administration before the 2000 election and the Bush-Gore election and the debacle in Florida. That really opened up a lot of eyes to what was going on with election administration, how we needed to think about and try to modernize and make our elections run better.
I think it's interesting that throughout the entire history, we have heard the allegations of fraud, and the modern studies, yours being one of them, have not found very much evidence of that. Daniel Takagi, you have also looked at voter fraud. What have you found?
I think that reflecting on what both Alex and Lori say, what we see nowadays is remarkably similar to the kinds of claims that we've seen for now about a century, right? That we don't really see a great deal of voter fraud nowadays. What we do see is people using voter fraud as an excuse to impose rules that have the effect of limiting participation by some people. And as Lori noted, we've seen this increasingly in the years since Bush versus Gore, which really focused public attention on how much these election administration rules matter. You know, I was struck by a couple of things that Alex mentioned that really resonate in terms of what's gone on recently. So in my own state of Ohio, we had the state legislature back in 2006 enact a requirement that naturalized citizens actually bring their certificates of naturalization to the poll and present them in the event that they were challenged. I was part of a legal team joined by the ACLU that went to court and had that rule struck down as violative of the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution. We also hear, especially in the last couple of years, a lot of arguments that are made in at least thinly veiled racial terms, concerns about quote-unquote urban voters, and sometimes explicitly. For example, in Franklin County, Ohio, where I live, we recently had the chairman of the county Republican Party and a member of the elections board say, quote, "I guess I really actually feel we shouldn't contort the voting process to accommodate the urban, read African-American voter turnout machine." So this was in reference to early voting, and basically what he was trying to do, joined by his Republican counterparts, is to limit early voting and particularly to take away weekend early voting, which is used by a lot of African-American voters. So it's really quite remarkable in 2012 that we see these attempts to make it more difficult for some people to vote, often cast in impliedly and even sometimes explicitly racial terms.
Both of you have mentioned Florida as a turning point, the 2000 election, Bush v. Gore. I believe, Professor Kasar, you were also the one who said what we've learned from Florida is that there isn't a constitutional right to vote in the way we had interpreted it. So that's actually one kind of a turning point. But then the other kind of a turning point is, even though the courts had really ruled in favor of George W. Bush, there's been a partisan flip on how to use what happened in Florida. Would you say that's accurate?
Well, I think it is, although I will defer to Dan Takagi on questions of constitutional law in the courts. But on your broader point, I do think that the 2000 election was an inflection point in a lot of ways. I mean, it opened our collective eyes, and I think this includes a lot of scholars as well as citizens who don't do this for a living. It opened our collective eyes to the weaknesses of the legal and procedural frameworks surrounding the right to vote. We all heard, for example, the secretaries of state of other states saying, "There, but for the grace of God, go I," talking about Florida, that their own systems were just as weak and fallible. And we learned that certainly in the case of presidential elections that we do not have a right to vote unless and until our state legislatures tell us that we can have elections. Let me try to take a couple of these threads together or tie them together. And I think the question of Lorraine Minetti's point about why is this happening now, I think it's appropriate that we see the 2000 election as a kind of turning point or inflection point, among not just because it woke us up, but it also underscored to all the political professionals, the people who run campaigns, that a handful of votes can mean control of the national government. That was a lesson. They sort of knew that, but it reminded them of the importance of that. But that's an inflection point. I think that when I look at the larger story, there are other forces at work that I think have led to this wave of voter suppression. One, again, like the late 19th century, is that this is a period of very close national elections. Party competition is very bitter, and the parties are very balanced nationally. And the other is the entrance into the electorate of large numbers of new voters or people from different ethnic and racial groups. In the late 19th century, what you had was a lot of black voters who had entered in after the Civil War and after Reconstruction or during Reconstruction. And what we see in the modern world is, thanks to the Voting Rights Act, an engaged African-American electorate in large parts of the country. And now we have the largest wave of immigration since 1910 and perhaps even longer. We have lots of new voters. And I think that those broad forces are just as important as perhaps the specific precipitant of the 2000 election.
Lorraine Minetti, that actually brings in coordinated effort used in order to change some of these laws. You've written about some things that were directly occurring within the Bush administration. Can you tell us about some of those?
The Bush administration, after the Florida election in 2000, resurrected a program within the Justice Department, which they called the Ballot Access and Voting Integrity Initiative. It was the same name that had been given a project in the Reagan Justice Department to do the same thing, which was to go out and root out voter fraud, and the Bush administration said voter fraud and voter intimidation. And it was a program that involved bringing U.S. attorneys or their designated officers to Washington once or twice a year for special training on how to identify voter fraud and voter intimidation and what the rules were, and then to go back to their districts and to publicize the fact that they, as representatives of the federal government during federal elections, were available to take calls and to investigate and to follow up on allegations of fraud and intimidation and prosecute and so forth. And that program, where you had the full force of the federal government looking for voter fraud, really was a bust in terms of what it produced with respect to actual cases of voter fraud. I used the data from that program to make this case that, in fact, the federal government went looking for it in federal elections, found very, very little of it. Over the first 3 years of the program, they identified just 40 voters who may have violated the law. They didn't even convict that many.
Before you go on, 40 voters out of how many?
If you counted the two federal elections in that period, the 2002 and the 2004 election. It was over 200 million votes. And so it's quite a poor record, I think, of identifying this. It doesn't make sense for voters to do it. But all of this was to add to what I have also written about as a kind of propaganda campaign to promote the idea that voter fraud was a very serious problem, that the numbers of the kind that I would cite were really not relevant because you couldn't know how much was being committed. Nobody really knew. You couldn't use, in a sense, crime statistics, even though that is how we measure the incidence of crime, and to scare people into thinking that their vote was being undermined by all this fraudulent voting, by undocumented aliens, by felons, all kinds of people who were not eligible. You know, the implication was weren't worthy citizens. And so you have to both promote the idea that the vote is the sanctity of the vote, that it's so sacred that only some people can actually have access to it. You have to kind of promote that idea. Again, I think because you had to kind of work a little bit to convince the public that some of the laws then that flowed from that, like voter ID laws and cutting back on third-party registration activity and moving into cutting back on early voting and so forth, to convince the public that there really was a threat of this problem. And we'd be willing to sort of sacrifice, erring on the side of caution, if you will. Some people lost their vote through that process. That was just the price we were going to have to pay. So in terms of the whole set of laws that flow from that, there was this sort of program at the Justice Department early on which sent the signal, again, that the federal government at that time was very involved. They were going to be tracking it down, felony. And for people who are sort of political junkies and remember this, you remember the U.S. attorney scandal in the Justice Department. And two of those U.S. attorneys, they were Bush-appointed attorneys, were doing their job. And when they didn't bring prosecutions because there was no evidence to bring them, they ended up getting fired, and that kind of blew up, and we got a window onto the politicization of this idea that we had to bring the FBI and the Justice Department in. It was such a serious problem.
So if we fast forward now, the Brennan Center has recently written a report saying there have been something like 180 bills introduced that would all really essentially be a type of voter suppression. It's across about 41 states. Some of these have been overturned by the courts. What is remaining? What did the court overturn in terms of the most meaningful ones? And what is the current landscape as a result of this? Daniel Takagi.
It's a bit complicated because, contrary to popular belief, we don't have one election system or even just 50 in the United States. We've really got thousands, one for each of the local jurisdictions that's responsible for running our elections. That said, it actually has been quite remarkable how active, and appropriately so, in my view, the courts have been in stopping some of the most aggressive attempts to make it more difficult for people to vote and have their vote counted in the United States. And let me just give three examples of that. One has been in the area of voter identification, where we've seen in some states state courts striking down very restrictive voter ID laws, most notably Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, both swing states in the presidential election, on the ground that they violated their state constitutions. We've also seen in South Carolina and Texas the Voting Rights Act used to stop at least temporarily voter ID laws in those states from going into effect. We've seen some of the attempts to limit early voting, which, as I mentioned earlier, is at least in some places used more heavily by people of color, especially on the weekends through Souls to the Polls programs and the like. And some states have tried to cut back their early voting, but they've at least been partly stopped in two important swing states in 2012, namely Florida and my own state of Ohio, where the Obama campaign went to court and was successful in getting early voting reinstated for everyone the 3 days immediately before the election. And a final example is provisional voting. This is also something that tends to be really important. There are a lot of voters who, this is one of the reforms that was enacted by the Help America Vote Act of 2002. In some states, including my state of Ohio, we've got into the hundreds of thousands of people who cast provisional ballots, and disputes have arisen about whether those provisional ballots should be counted when the voter is required to cast a provisional ballot due to a poll worker error. A federal court in Ohio has said it violates the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution to reject a voter's ballot due to somebody else's, namely a poll worker's error. So I think there have been a lot of attempts to make it more difficult to vote, mostly enacted by Republican legislative bodies in 2011 into 2012. But the good news here is that the courts, including a lot of Republican-appointed judges, have been pretty vigorous this year, surprisingly so to a lot of people, in standing up to at least the worst examples of vote suppression. As Alex mentioned earlier, Bush versus Gore said there's no right to vote in presidential elections, which is to say that the state legislature could decide if they wanted to not to have elections for president and to appoint electors in a different way. But once we are allowed to vote in elections, voters have to be treated equally. That's what our Equal Protection Clause requires, and that is what the fundamental right to vote at its core means, that all voters have to be treated equally in a democracy that's committed to the principle of one person, one vote.
So we are expecting to have a very close presidential election. The polls, even though we don't know how much we can rely on them these days, in a lot of the swing states are showing pretty neck and neck between the two major candidates. How much can these efforts really throw an election? Perhaps we should start with the historian, Alexander Kasar.
We do know that historically there have been elections that the outcome of which has been influenced, I mean, some elections in the distant past, by laws. I mean, I studied one voter registration law actually in Pennsylvania from 1906, and it was very clear that a new registration law had cut the size of the electorate in half and changed the outcome. That can happen. In the current circumstances and looking at this election, I think the answer is that we don't know what kind of impact these measures will have. The measures have spawned efforts by the Democratic Party and by lots of grassroots organizing groups to make sure that people do have the requisite ID if they need it and to get people registered and out to vote. And it also turns out to be a methodologically very complicated thing to measure what impact these laws will or might have. The only honest answer I can give is that we don't know, but in an election this close, a law which affected 1,000 people, 250 people, could make a difference. And interestingly, and I'm thinking about the Pennsylvania case and some of the misinformation which seems to be still abroad in Pennsylvania about the ID law, which is not going to be invoked in this election, is that what people think maybe the state of the law could have an impact even aside from what the law itself says. In other words, if you think, because you were told before or because there's rumors around, that you have to have a certain kind of document, you may decide not to show up if you don't have that document.
Lorraine Minnity.
I live in the Philadelphia media market, and every day, just yesterday, I saw on television one of these ads that the Philadelphia Department of State has been running on their ID law, and the ad says, if you want to vote, and then the person in the ad holds up an ID card, bring this, and then the voiceover says, in this election, you will be asked for but not required to show ID. Now, how confusing is that? It very much makes it look like you have to bring the ID.
And in terms of impact that it will have on people either participating because of these measures or either not showing up or throwing the election one way or the other, do you have a sense as a political scientist what could occur?
Well, I want to echo what Alex was saying about measurement complexity. It's always difficult to measure something that doesn't happen. And we would have it again in trying to assess the extent to which people did not show up. I think it's most likely that the people who are going to be affected are the people who've been targeted, in a sense, by these laws. And that would be, I would say, new voters, because it can be very confusing about where to go. And you, if you're in a big city, sometimes you go into a polling place, you go to this table or that table, you have to sign in, where do I stand, et cetera. It can be a little daunting if you're a first-time voter, and maybe you're 20 years old and not too experienced with this sort of thing. So new voters can get confused by all of this and maybe turn away. Voters who have fewer, say, sort of resources, they could be educational resources, the ability to understand more complex instructions, or poor people who don't have a lot of time to stand in line, people not able as easily to overcome these sorts of barriers. You know, middle-class people, college-educated people, people with money, people with time, these kinds of new requirements that have been placed on people in many states, they don't seem like such a big deal to bring an ID, for example. But for people who are new, who are doing this for the first time, who are young, who are poor, these laws will have a disproportionate sort of negative impact on them.
Just yesterday, the Associated Press had published a piece saying that voter suppression tactics were on the rise nationwide, and they were becoming more sophisticated, and they weren't really as able to be addressed by the current laws that we have in place. Daniel Takagi.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what they're referring to in their story, but we certainly have seen attempt through the enactment of laws and through the enforcement of laws by state and local authorities to make it more difficult for some people to vote. And I think it's hard to deny that in many instances that's not only the effect but the purpose of those laws, like very restrictive voter ID rules, like limitations on early voting, like rules about which provisional ballots won't count. Our laws actually might be enforced better, but we have the tools to fight those tactics. If I might just respond to the point about the magnitude of these changes and how many votes they affect, Alex and Lori are quite right to note that we don't know the exact number, but I think we do have some sense of scale. And are these changes enough to affect an election? The answer is, if the margin is something like it was in Ohio 2004, where we had well over 100,000 votes separating the presidential candidates in the pivotal state, no. But if it's something like Florida 2000, where the candidates were separated by just a few hundred votes, I think it's quite likely that restrictions on voting, like voter ID requirements, like restrictions on early voting, could affect the result.
Just as I wanted to back up into what some of these tactics were, they weren't actually just law. They were acts of political deception, people telling elderly voters that they would come to the door and say, we are authorized to collect your absentee ballots, when in fact they weren't authorities. These kinds of tactics were the ones that the Associated Press was referring to and saying that our current laws are not really adequate to address these.
And yeah, I'm skeptical of that kind of claim, because I think that sort of thing, right, would almost surely count as electoral fraud in the states. The difficulty is really catching people. Other things like billboards we've seen going up in areas saying things like voting fraud is a crime, which we've seen in some instances in minority neighborhoods in places like Ohio that are key swing states. It seems to me pretty obvious that that's designed to depress turnout in those communities, but it's also free speech that's protected by the First Amendment, and in my view should be, so long as it is truthful, which in this case the billboard was. So on those kinds of tactics, I think either they're likely to be ones that can be addressed by existing laws if we're able to actually catch the people, or they involve protected activity under the First Amendment.
All right. Thank you to the three of you for being with us. Alexander Kasar, professor of history and social policy at Harvard University, author of The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States. Daniel Takagi is professor of law, senior fellow of election law at Ohio State University, and co-author of Casebook Election Law, co-editor of the Election Law Journal. Lorraine Menity is professor of public policy and administration, director of undergraduate urban studies at Rutgers University. She's the author of The Myth of Voter Fraud and the co-author of Keeping Down the Black Vote, Race and Demobilization of American Voters. Thank you all so very much.
Thank you.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to producers Ankine Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin, and assistant producers Amanda Vigil and Kenneth Jackson. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can get it from kpfk.org and click on the archives, or from Armudian.com, scholarcircle.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Armudian. Have a great day, and we'll see you next week.